Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with Kelby Uchley, whose new book is Bayou Darbon Swamp, a naturalist's memoir of place. Say that Kelby Uchley was born to write his most recent book, Bayou Darbon Swamp, a naturalist's memoir of place. It's a beautiful chronicle of time in the North Louisiana swamp of the same name and his work with the National Wildlife Refuge Program. He's the author of many books, including Bayou Diversity, Nature and People in the Louisiana Bayou Country. Kelby is a former U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologist, a fitting career for a boy whose first pet was a baby alligator. So, Kelby Uchley, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you very much, Susan.
So, for those who don't know, tell us a little bit about Bayou Darbon, where it is, your longstanding relationship with it. This is where you grew up and where your family's from.
That's true, at least my father's side of the family. The bayou itself lies mostly in union with the lower end of it being in Ouachita parishes. It is, at least for this part of the world, a fairly good-sized bayou. The bayou and its swamp is what I like to think of it as, because the bayou itself is the driver of the swamp.
Mm-hmm.
There has been a lot of historical changes associated with the bayou. It was the upper end of it was dammed in the late 60s. And several other things have happened to it over the years. And I actually grew up on the south end of the bayou, just up the hill, out of the way of the floodwaters, and up until the time I went off to school and to college, and was gone for a number of years, worked in other parts of the state, and then came back here about 30 years ago, and my wife and I built a house on the opposite end of the swamp, and we have lived here for about the last 30 years. And during that time, I became manager of the National Wildlife Refuge, Darbon National Wildlife Refuge, which overlays a significant part of the swamp. So I've come at it at a lot of different angles, from a boy fishing and learning about the outdoors on one end, to trying to take care of it professionally, I guess, at the other end.
And you call your home Heartwood. I thought that was a really lovely name.
Yeah, we have a bit of property here that was old family property that my great-grandfather had, and it got out of the family for a number of years, and we were able to piecemeal it back together, and it has a part of it has some very big old timber that has not been exploited like most of the rest of the forest lands in this part of the world. So there's a lot of big trees, and that's where the name Heartwood came from.
You grew up fishing and hunting, and one of the threads that runs through this book is fathers and sons and families and how nature is a part of family life in that part of the state.
Yeah, and I'm not sure it's any different than it is in many other parts of the state. I've worked in the coastal marshes on National Wildlife Refuges in central Louisiana, and of Oil's Parish, and over in the Delta lands. And those traditions, I found are pretty much cosmopolitan, at least within the state of Louisiana. And so it's not that different here, but it's important. And I think it's a way of life that is not as prevalent as it was when I was a boy, for whatever reason. I think kids have other interests now. A lot of them do.
Now, two of the writers who seem to have inspired you the most are Aldo Leopold and, of course, Henry David Thoreau. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about nature writing and writing about the environment and what you bring to it when you sit down to do it.
Oh, me. You know, one of the things I try to do out there is, as a professional wildlife biologist and a person who has spent a great deal of time outdoors, is to help people understand how the natural world works.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's based on my experience of spending lots of days and lots of nights out in these areas. I think, you know, there's a road that runs through the edge of this swamp, a major highway.
Mm-hmm.
And there are thousands of cars that go up and down this highway every day through this forested wetland. And you look out the window, and I'm convinced that most of these people don't really know what they're seeing there, don't really understand what goes on, why this swamp is important to them, why they should care about it. And so by using anecdotes, mostly first-person type stories that I have experienced, you know, I hope to help folks have a better understanding of you know, what's out there in the natural world.
I have to say, you are the master of the dramatic sentence. I mean, there are some things in this book that stop you in your tracks. Here's one. Boiling rat skulls on a Coleman stove in my soon-to-be wife's bedroom in her parents' house was one of the steps I undertook to learn the names of wild animals. That's an image I'm never going to forget.
She is chuckling in the background here. The field of biology has its peculiarities, I guess, you know, and which are quite different from the way some other folks in terms of educational experiences, and that was certainly one of them.
So what did her parents say? I have to know.
Being they were both working out of the house, I doubt those things actually happened when they were home.
Okay.
We knew about how much we could get away with.
And there was another one. John Harris lay face down on the bottom of Bayou Darbon in 10 feet of water.
Yeah. To me, that's an amazing thing that was going on right there. And I try to pass that along on to my readers to give them, you know, a visual idea of what's happening.
Well, and tell us what he was doing, which I thought was so interesting.
Okay. What he was doing was actually surveying for mussels, which are, akin to the it's the group of organisms that oysters belong to,
mm-hmm.
shellfish, and they're freshwater versions of that. And he was a biologist from a university in Arkansas who was conducting a survey of the different mussel types in this bayou here, and that's the way he does it. He puts on a type of scuba gear and goes to the bottom and creeps along on the muddy, dark bottoms of the bayou, feeling for mussels. So that was what was going on there. But the reason he was doing that is because mussels are an indicator species. And there are many different types of mussels, and the presence of some types of mussels in a given area are indicators of the the biological health of that system, because they don't tolerate things like silt and pollutants and things. But that's what was going on there.
It was pretty interesting, I have to say. I didn't know there were swamp mussels.
There's quite a few mussels around, but not as many as they used to be. There used to be because of some of the some of our economic-driven exploitation activities.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Kelby Oochley about his new book, Bayou Darbon Swamp, A Naturalist's Memoir of Place. In this book, there are great stories about your life and wildlife and fisheries. I mean, Naked Fornicators in the Swamp was a pretty good one.
Yeah. I was part of my job description had a paragraph at the end that sort of said something to do with other duties as assigned. And one of those duties for actually my entire career was to serve as a federal game warden.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a collateral duty I did in addition to other things that my job required. So particularly in serving in that capacity, we would come across some peculiar incidents on wild public lands.
Well, I'd expect the hunters over the limit. I mean, that was no surprise.
Well, people... particularly people that are maybe have grown up in the city and are not familiar with wild natural areas often think of them as, places where no one else goes, and they think they can go out there and be in the middle of a wilderness area and do just about everything and get away with it. And they're quite surprised when there are more folks around looking at them as they might otherwise suspect.
Were you ever afraid?
I can't ever remember being afraid at the time. And I always figured that those times that I was actually in dangerous situations, I didn't really know it at the time until afterwards. So that was... I probably was more often than I would like to know, I don't ever remember being afraid. We had the best training in the United States. The government was very proactive in that, and in general, I felt very comfortable.
Well, one of the things about the landscape in New Orleans and Louisiana and the challenges we face is the overwhelming bureaucracy. There are so many organizations and so many institutions involved in the sorts of things we need to do to keep this fragile ecosystem going. And so I wonder if you could kind of explain to us where the National Wildlife Refuge Program fits into that.
Okay. The National Wildlife Refuge System is a system of about probably close to 550 national wildlife refuges scattered across the country. They're in every state now.
Mm-hmm.
They are an agency or an entity within the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is administered by the Department of Interior. And they're basically a sister agency of the National Park Service. So you have national parks and you have national wildlife refuges, which are, in both cases, most often expanses of natural lands that belong to the federal government that are managed for specific purposes, usually to protect them. But national parks and national wildlife refuges are very different in that they have a different body of laws that say what can go on within the boundaries of each of those entities. And for instance, there are things that will happen in national parks that can't be allowed in national wildlife refuges. Mm-hmm. Because whatever happens in a national wildlife refuge, priorities have to be given to the plants and animals there first. So you won't see a big Yellowstone lodge and restaurant built on a national wildlife refuge.
Uh-huh.
So there are, and I lose count now, there are quite a few national wildlife refuges in Louisiana, scattered all over the state, beginning with the Delta National Wildlife Refuge down at the very tip of the boot below Venice, several across the coastal marshes, Sabine, Lacassine, and then a few interior ones in the middle of the state, like on Catahoula Lake and Grand Cote, and then a few up in the north part of the state. And each of them was created for a special purpose, to protect a certain type of habitat, or in some instances, a certain type of plant or animal. So that's sort of the way they fit in. They're federal lands within the Department of Interior that are managed for very specific reasons.
And what is your favorite part about this work?
Oh, you know, I think it was really the diversity of the work, because mm-hmm. I never knew from day to day what I was going to be involved in. As manager of one of these national wildlife refuges, you're responsible for everything that goes on there.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's all the different public use programs, whether it be hunting and fishing, environmental education, maintenance of the roads and trails and facilities, visitor centers. You know, it may be doing some investigating of poacher complaints, speaking at civic groups. It was just a very diverse job. And one of the things that I quickly learned that certainly was not taught in college, in graduate school, which, you know, was a, and it resulted for me in a degrees in wildlife and fishery science and wildlife management. And that was that the hardest thing to do in terms of managing areas like this is not managing the wildlife, the plants and wildlife, but managing people.
Right.
Something that wasn't taught very well. When you take care of those critters fairly easily, most of the time, it's the folks that are interacting with these same areas where the problems crop up.
Well, you make that point over and over again. You know, like if we just left some things alone, they would have been fine. I mean,
yeah, that's true.
So how did writing enter into this for you? I mean, you've said that you and Amy were hermits to start with, but it sounds like a pretty busy life for a hermit and a life
yeah.
filled with people.
Well, personally, you know, I spent a career writing what I call government ease, which wasn't very exciting, and had all kind of sideboards on it. And I guess I've always liked to write. I just never had time or an outlet. And when I retired, and I've been retired going on 15 years now, I got this freedom to do a lot of things, to look at a lot of different avenues out there that I wanted to travel on, and they resulted in several books, most of which, of course, have a natural history bent. But this one in particular was a little different because I'm a science guy, and for the most part, when you're writing science papers or science articles, you don't use the word I. And it was very difficult for me in this book to get used to that, to say I did this or I saw that or whatever. So I had to overcome that, because you certainly can't write a memoir without using the word I.
And it was your life with Amy as well, too.
That's right. We think every day that it was a miracle that we crossed paths. And we did that in a mountain biology field camp remote mountains of North Arkansas back in school, and we have been following each other around in the woods and the swamps ever since.
Well, what was it like to raise kids in this kind of environment?
You know, our kids, they in several places that we've worked, we actually lived out on the National Wildlife Refuge in government houses, and our kids grew up, you know, out in these areas. I mean, in the swamps and paddling piros, and we didn't even cut them any slack when we went on vacations in the summer, because we would leave these fascinating natural areas and go to other ones on vacation out west. We were always worried that we were going to burn them out.
Mm-hmm.
And we probably did for a long time. And they grew up to be architects and attorneys and moved away. And for a period of time in their lives, they weren't very active in these type of activities. But lo and behold, they have come around and come back to them. And so something soaked in, and they are actually, avid outdoors people now and love these same type of places that we did.
Well, we live in such a terrifying time when you look at the environment, and it's, I mean, do you feel an increased urgency as you write to get this message out so people appreciate what we have and how we should take care of it? Do you feel hopeful, or you feel like you're fighting a losing battle? I mean, what keeps you going in doing this?
Can't throw in the towel yet. there's one thread that, run through most of my books. It's that, we're connected to this natural world.
Right.
Our well-being is dependent on the well-being of, these places where we live and make our living. And so I'm not gonna give up on that for the time being. When I get really down in the dumps, I try to start thinking in geological time, and that helps for a bit.
That's one way to look at it. When they invent the geological watch, we'll be in great shape.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But I loved it. I mean, so many things come alive in this book. The plants, the animals, just a sense of detail. I mean, I will forever know that you are a lover of spotted bass. I mean, that's...
Right.
And I gained a new appreciation for the black bear as well. So it was just, everything came alive in your work, I think.
Thank you very much. It was a fun book to write. Again, it was a very different one than anything I've done before.
Well, and I don't think it's any accident that you've written a book about the American alligator after your first experience with one. So what's next? What will you be doing next?
Gosh, I don't know. Some people say I've already written much more than I know, so I don't know if there's anything out there, but I'll probably go stir crazy if I'm not working on something, regardless of what happens to it.
Well, keep doing what you're doing, because these are beautiful, beautiful books. So we've been talking with Kelby Uchley, whose new book is Bayou Darbon Swamp, A Naturalist's Memoir of Place. You can meet him at this year's Tennessee Williams and New Orleans Literary Festival. Check out TennesseeWilliams.net for details. Kelby, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Susan. I really enjoyed it.
Me too. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The Tennessee Williams and New Orleans Literary Festival is partnering with Baldwin & Company Coffee and Bookstore for a series of free monthly writing workshops. First up, Alex Jennings, author of The Ballad of Perilous Graves.
Saturday, February 4th from 10 to noon. Free, but register in advance at TennesseeWilliams.net. An informal screenwriting group meets from 5:30 to 7:30 Monday nights at the Lakeshore Library, 1000 Esplanade Avenue in Metairie. Library patrons will learn techniques to develop a screenplay, brainstorm ideas with fellow writers, as well as critique each other's work. Writing supplies are provided, but laptops are encouraged. Jamila Minix appears in conversation with Maurice Carlos Ruffin and signs her debut novel, Moonrise Over New Jessup. It was the winner of the 2021 Penn Bellwether Prize for Socially Engaged Fiction. The event is Wednesday, February 8th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Nancy Wilson, author of Mamere's Country Creole Cookbook, Recipes and Memories from Louisiana's German Coast, conducts a food demonstration Wednesday, February 8th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. This will be followed by a drink demo from Latrice McGill. The Dead Poets Society meets Thursday, February 9th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Library patrons read the poems of poets who are no longer with us. Shakespeare, John Donne, Robert Frost, take your pick.
Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, with major support from Rouse's Markets. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.